So, what needs to be done in your downtown? And how does it feel when you're there these days? It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and this pandemic has changed the way we see our places, where we go, and why we go there. Most polling shows that employees have come to prefer a hybrid model of doing some work from home and some from the office. We've come to count on that flexibility, but our real estate, our places, are just beginning to adapt. We're looking at the future of place and building a center where we feel like we all belong. Employers and employees alike, we want to hear what you think about your workplace at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Jennifer Vey. She's a senior fellow with Brookings Metro and the director of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking at Brookings. Vey's work focuses on how place-based policies and practices can generate widespread social, economic, and environmental benefits. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate your perspective because my downtown I've been wondering about, and I'd like to know how you've seen downtowns since the pandemic. What have you seen change since for the last 2 years?
Sure. Well, I think it might be important actually to start with what was happening before COVID in downtowns, and that gives us a bit of a perspective on what's going on now. So, if you look back in the last century, this was a period where the country was rapidly suburbanizing and, most cities actually experienced a lot of loss of residents and jobs during that era. And then starting in the 1990s, we began to see something of a back to the city movement. Suburban growth still dominated, but we saw a lot of cities seeing the return of residents and economic activity that really gained momentum and, has largely continued. And in fact, downtowns were really a key part of that back to the city story, with some of the first areas in these cities that were actually experiencing growth, in fact, were those downtowns or those central business districts. And they were actually driving a lot of that growth overall. So just to give you, just a perspective on what did that growth actually look like, a few of my colleagues at Brookings conducted some analysis on downtown population growth from about 1980 to 2018, looking specifically at downtown populations in our top 100 metro areas, meaning the largest areas of collections of cities and counties across the country. And so from 1980 to about 1990, the populations of these metros grew about 13%, while downtowns actually were losing population on the whole. And in fact, about 58 of these 100 downtowns that they studied actually lost population. And then things really started to change in the 1990s. And it was during that time downtowns began to experience a lot of population growth, growth that then just really continued to accelerate in the decades that followed and really continued all the way through their study period, which again was 2018. Growth wasn't universal. It was taking place, largely in large metro areas, while a lot of your smaller metros around the country, it was a mixed bag there in terms of downtown growth. But on the whole, you really started to see downtowns as part of this comeback in this pre-pandemic era, in those pre-pandemic decades. And, at the same time, so you were seeing populations come back, you were seeing job growth in most downtowns as well. Madison and Milwaukee, for example, were big parts of this story. In both places, downtowns actually grew all four decades and really even outpaced a lot of growth that was happening in the surrounding county and the surrounding metro areas. You really saw that boom in those places and around the country. But of course, now we're, as everybody knows, we're at a different time. And I think this is the big question of, okay, we saw all this growth pre-pandemic, pandemic came, and a lot of downtowns have naturally been very, very hard hit. And there's real reason for this. From a real estate perspective, downtowns are really defined by a dominance of office space in aggregate across the downtown neighborhoods in the 30 largest U.S. metro areas, for example. Offices make up about 70% of real estate. That's even higher in places like Chicago and D.C., where it's up to about 90% of that real estate is in the office market. And, prior to COVID, these spaces really commanded a real premium just based on, look, these are the central parts of cities, they're dense, they were largely vibrant. And so they were, this real estate was of high value. And so then given what the real estate looks like and given, you know, the dominance of office space, you can really understand why downtowns have taken such a hit during the pandemic. So, you know, as you noted at the top of the show, obviously during COVID, a lot of white collar office workers weren't going into the office at all for a long period of time. Now they're starting to come back slowly in some places, but it's starting to happen. But I think we're pretty sure that, you know, most workers aren't necessarily going to be coming back to the same extent that they were before. They may not be coming back 5 days a week, every single day. They are probably going to be coming back at some sort of hybrid model. This is obviously then has ripple effects on all, not only that real estate, we can talk a little bit about that, but certainly has had a lot of ripple effects on all the other businesses that depended on that population. Think of all the eateries that closed down during the pandemic, or maybe were, you know, hanging on by the fingernails. All the other kind of service-oriented businesses that depended on that downtown office population, and that, you know, office courthouses also closed down. So you can see how now we're in this position. People are looking around their downtown saying, oh boy, we're not seeing a lot of people down here anymore. We see a lot of businesses that might have been shuttered during this period. So it opens up big questions about what happens now.
We're talking about the future of downtown with Jennifer Vey. She's a senior fellow with Brookings Metro, and we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Have you worked remotely during the pandemic? Do you miss your downtown office, or do you prefer working at home? What about the choice between going to the kitchen for a cup of coffee or going around the corner to the coffee shop? And should employers offer some flexible hybrid work policies? What to do with downtowns in this pandemic and as we look beyond? Jennifer, what decisions are employers trying to grapple with right now as they make the tough decisions about where their employees should work?
Sure. Yep. This is everybody's in decision mode, right? just given and trying to predict the future a little bit, which is awfully hard. So, you know, first of all, if you look at the last couple of years, so you've had a lot of federal dollars coming into cities that at least were starting to try to buoy local governments, transit agencies, downtown businesses to some extent. Now we're in this third year of the pandemic, and what we can really see as we look ahead is that, all right, we're at a point now where we know that really fundamental change is needed. Things aren't going to look like they did before. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think a lot of workers like hybrid work. I think it works well for people in terms of work-life family balance, for example, at least for people who have that option. Obviously, many, many people do not have that option. But in the downtown context, where we're talking about a lot of office workers, that's certainly true. And so public and private entities that depend on, you know, people and businesses being downtown are really going to just need a path to a new kind of normal. So first, as we think about that, the future is really still is going to require plenty of office workers. And we will likely see them. Again, more people are starting to come back to downtown now, at least part of the time. And that's likely to continue to be the case. New variants and things of COVID notwithstanding in the short term. But if we look over the longer trajectory, you could see a situation where as more people come back, more people see their coworkers going back, you get a little bit of a virtuous cycle. Still, it's unlikely that workers in a lot of these businesses or industries are gonna come back full time. And so firms are gonna have to reassess exactly how much space they need if more of their employees aren't there all the time. Aside from the how much question, they're also really gonna need to consider what kind of space they need. And this really depends largely on the kind of work that people are actually doing well in the office. If you're bringing people back, you sort of have to, you'll ask questions around, well, why are people coming mm-hmm. back? If they've been able to work effectively at home, what's the benefit of bringing people back into the office? And so if that's for collaboration, for example, you want people to have face-to-face time in order to collaborate on, you know, work projects and other things. If it's to sort of build camaraderie among your office, right? That sense of unity, then you're going to need some new spaces that support that kind of environment, right?
Or just to have a conversation that's not on Zoom.
Exactly. Think of all those serendipitous interactions that you want to have. I know when I've gone back in the office, how many times it's so nice to see somebody just pop their head in, whether to say hi or to ask that like quick question that you're not going to call somebody up on Zoom or on Teams or whatever, but you just have that, you know, 30-second question that you want to ask somebody. So you want to create that kind of office environment that's really going to support, you know, that kind of interaction. And that might mean rethinking what your physical space of your office looks like. Are you creating more spaces where people actually can get together as opposed to, you know, you're coming in from home for the day and then you're just going to an office and shutting the door. People are going to come back in. You want to, you know, make sure that that time is being used how you want it to be. So that's partly what a lot of employers, I think, are considering.
Let's hold there, Jennifer. Jennifer Vey joins us over Zoom, by the way, this morning. It's not lost on me. She's a senior fellow with Brookings Metro and the director of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking at Brookings. And we want to hear from you, too, about the future of your downtown, what you think it should include, how it should feel for you as compared to how it may feel right now at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. There's also the story of how city governments will play a role here, how developers will play a role here, and what it will look like by the time we get to whatever the new normal may be. What do you see? You tell us. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So if employees prefer a hybrid of working from both home and the office, how can your downtown become more of a hybrid too? And what's that look like exactly? How's it feel to you? And is it going to work? It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the director of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking at Brookings, Jennifer Vey. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, your colleague, Tracy Haddon Lowe, an article in The Atlantic I read yesterday, made the case that America's downtowns should be going hybrid. And she explained in some of the ways the roles that everybody would play. But what are some ways that cities can adapt, you know, office-dominated real estates going forward?
Sure. So, you know, we talked about the office, you know, office spaces and employees coming back and really what that means for firms. But there's a whole, you know, bigger question here around downtowns more broadly. So this idea of a hybrid downtown is, okay, you've got a lot of office space downtown. We have seen, as I noted, you know, a lot of residents moving back to downtown. But as we look towards that future, we need to think about all the kinds of different people and activities we want to see in these spaces. So first of all, beyond office workers, downtown will continue to need more residents. And hopefully we'll continue to see some of that growth that we were seeing over the past several decades continue. But they'll also need more shoppers and visitors and tourists and students. Just more people, more businesses, more entertainment options, more public spaces, and all sorts of events and other things that can really get people to come downtown. So part of this is that city and city leaders particularly need to think a lot differently, maybe, about the public realm. This is something that's certainly in their purview. So if you think about downtowns, you know, over a number of decades, particularly, you know, in the latter part of the last century, and it, you know, a lot of these patterns continue today. A lot of the goal was, you know, look, get people from the suburbs into downtown. Maybe they go into their office. Maybe they get a bite to eat during the day, and then they head home at the end of the day. And, you know, that's why you see, you know, roads that were widened during this era, a lot of one-way streets, other kind of, you know, design functions that really were meant to get people in and out of downtown. And so that certainly needs to change. And now what cities really need to focus on is how are you bringing people into downtown and how are you keeping them there? And so thinking about access for one thing, you know, multimodal access, you know, the pedestrian experience, transit, bike lanes, other types of, you know, scooters, other things that allow people, first of all, just to access downtown in better ways and give them a different kind of experience doing that. Thinking about all the kind of activities that can occur downtown. I mean, central business districts, there really are, you know, they truly are the focal point or should be the focal point for larger regions. They were, you know, they were what grew up initially in cities. And so, you know, we want them to be places where people want to be. And so cities working with civic organizations, a lot of downtown groups, for example, already were doing some of this investment, you know, in public spaces, in different kinds of events and programming. You know, maybe it's lunchtime, you know, music that's available, parades, you know, Saturday afternoon activities for families, all those sorts of things. Cities need to think, and again, the nonprofit sector really need to think carefully about, all right, what can we be doing to bring people down, you know, downtown, and actually to, you know, keep them here and make it feel like a space where they really want to be.
Jennifer, one of the questions I had about that was about transportation, which can be difficult in a downtown area. And as we've had streets become more pedestrian friendly during the pandemic, and as we look to bring people back downtown, how do you weigh the issues of transportation and pedestrians, automobiles, and everything else that comes there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in some ways, the short answer is that downtowns really, they need to embrace their cityness. Right. I think, you know, for so long, even a lot of downtowns, even those that were coming back again, you know, there was people, it was about moving people in and, you know, back out of downtown. And that's why even in a lot of downtowns, you still see a lot of surface parking lots, for example, a lot of parking in downtowns. And I think we're now at a time where during the pandemic, you saw how, you know, once we started to take the streets back from cars and give them back to people, you know, think of all the eateries that were able to use sidewalk space or parking spaces so that they could have outdoor dining, for example. Sometimes, you know, in some places where they might have closed streets or closed parts of streets so that people had more outdoor space in which to recreate. I think people really appreciated a lot of those changes. And so this is where cities have some control to say, all right, you know, what were some of these things that we did during the pandemic that worked? And how do we embrace who we are? These are dense places. They're already have, you know, are walkable. They already have, you know, a lot of real estate. They have historic buildings. They have entertainment venues. So how can they lean into that? And in order to create places that are more vibrant. And part of that is that cities need to really evaluate some of the regulatory frameworks that guide this. So thinking about zoning and permitting and building codes and incentives and other things that kind of grease those wheels a little bit so that you can allow more of this kind of activity. And it means that they may need to be starting to, you know, as we maybe pull back from some of the office and think about all the other uses in downtowns, residential uses, you know, hotel, schools, care facilities, all these other things. You know, how can cities help incent and facilitate building the kind of things that we now do need in downtowns, given all the shifts that we're seeing?
Jennifer Vey is a senior fellow with Brookings Metro and the director of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking at Brookings. And with downtown in mind, and there's still time for you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 about what you'd like to see in your downtown. And Jennifer, I want to ask about kids. You and your colleagues at Brookings have also written about the importance of child-friendly urban planning through playful learning landscapes. How do these installations and this program make downtown areas more family-friendly?
Sure. You know, I think that what we're really after here is to make downtowns a place where everybody feels welcome. You want a diversity of people, and you want the people who are using downtowns to be representative of your population. And so that means really thinking very broadly about issues around equity and inclusion, and that certainly, you know, families are a big part of that as well. So when we think about that, that means a few things. One, as people are coming back to downtowns, we want to make sure that we're creating downtowns where everybody feels like it's a place for them and that they feel very welcome there. We want to think about those surrounding neighborhoods, many of which do have families, and thinking about how they can benefit from changes that we may be seeing in downtowns in the future, how they can access downtowns in better ways, how activities and programming and design and other things benefit those people. And again, kids and families are a big part of that. And when we think about what does that mean, it can mean a lot of things, you know, investing in public spaces where, you know, that are friendly for families and for kids, whether that's pocket parks or other kind of spaces. We focus on this playful learning landscapes, which actually means how do you invest in installations in the public realm that not only are fun for kids, but also have a learning component as well. And so there's so much opportunity to just be thinking much more creatively about how we use our public spaces. So that all sorts of people feel like they want to be there.
It's fun to consider what could become of our downtown, especially since there are opportunities that seem to abound right now. Jennifer Vey, I want to thank you so much for your perspective this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Jennifer Vey is a senior fellow with Brookings Metro and the director of the Ante and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking at Brookings. News is next. Then the promise of more accurate predictions when it comes to election results. Can a free market help to reveal what voters like us are going to do come November? The money says yes. What do you think? I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. If the November elections were voted on today, Republicans in Wisconsin would win the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent, and that's according to the money at PredictIt.org. And PredictIt.org has been building a record of results that appear more accurate than most of our electoral polling and political pundits. So is a political stock exchange, a market of election outcomes, a better model for political prognostication? You tell me at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is the founder of the political stock market Predict It, John Aristotle Phillips. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be on.
So explain this a little bit for us. What is a prediction market and how does Predict It employ it?
Oh, well, prediction markets have been around for some time, and essentially they are structured as stock markets where you can buy or sell shares in what you think the outcome of an event will be. It doesn't have to be a political event. It can be a scientific discovery, when we think the first man or woman will walk on Mars. You make a forecast, and then you do that with real money. It's like a betting pool where the people who make the most accurate forecasts actually take the purse. Which consists of all the money that the others have bet. So it's a stock market.
And how long has Predict-It been around now, John?
Well, we started in 2014, right before the election. And it was slow at first. You know, people were sort of new to prediction markets. They had been around for some time, but as word got out, volume increased. We have a comment board, for instance, just by way of example. By 2016, there were more than 1 million comments on the Clinton race, the Clinton-Trump race. So that gives you an idea of how popular it is.
And how accurate have the results been when people put their actual money on the line when it comes to what in essence seems to be a futures market for what could happen? What do you find the results are?
Well, you know, it's not perfect 2020 vision into the future, but it's awfully close. And the markets have a way of correctly forecasting future outcomes, whether it's the price of soybeans, the cost of oil, or in this case, how an event is going to turn out. We have 350 different markets on Predict-It. All of them really focus on politics, but the principle applies to political forecasts as well. When you have real money on the line, it kind of clears your head, right? You start to think, not what do I want to have happen, but what do I think will happen? And when you focus on events like that, you're shifting from polling, which is asking people what they want to have happen, to forecasting markets or prediction markets. This is where you're putting your money down. And if you accurately forecast, you win a little money. And if you inaccurately forecast, you lose your money.
So when you look at the results and the odds and where the money falls, how often has the predicted market been accurate? Do you have an accuracy rate?
Yeah. So it depends on the nature of the forecast and the number of traders that are in the market. But you can have a relatively small number of traders in the market. A few hundred traders, for instance, will be able to more accurately forecast future events, especially when it comes to political outcomes, than most polls. So it's more accurate in that regard. Now, the further out you are from an event, actually the markets perform better than polling. Because really, who cares what people say they want to have happen back in, you know, January for a November election? What really matters is what's actually going to happen. Now, the two, polling and markets, sort of dovetail in accuracy as you get closer to the event that's being forecast. But markets are quite accurate. We have more than 100 universities and researchers and economists who are studying anonymized predicted data to understand why markets are as accurate as they are, or other things. For instance, what makes for a super forecaster?
Somebody who gets it right a lot. Somebody who does not get it wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that would be the definition. But why are some people better forecasters than others, for instance? And there are professors at universities that are looking specifically at that type of question to understand. Some people might be good at forecasting the outcome of the Iowa caucuses, and other people might be good at forecasting whether Putin will remain in office by the end of 2022. So forecasting accuracy on one subject may not translate. It often does, but may not translate to all markets.
How much money can I put down on an outcome?
Okay, so that's a great question. So it's limited in terms of how much you can put in. It's limited to $850 position limit in any of the markets. Now, you can be in more than one of these markets, but it's a maximum position limit of $850.
And what's the minimum I could put in?
Oh, you can put in as little as a penny. Right now, for instance, if you wanted to bet on the Milwaukee mayoral election winner, you could put a penny down and you win a buck. If Donovan is elected mayor,
it's 99 cents to one, isn't it, right now on predicted.org?
That's right. So these are $1 winner take all contracts, and you can buy up to $850 of them.
John Aristotle Phillips.
$1 winner.
Let me invite folks to join our conversation here. John Aristotle Phillips is the founder of the political stock market predicted.org. So what do you think about betting on politics? How accurate do you think polls are at gauging public opinion? We've heard that before on the morning show. And have you ever participated in a poll or bought shares in a prediction market? Would be interested in knowing your experience this morning at 1-800-642-1234, or always email ideas at WPR.org. So, John, I think you alluded to this a little bit, but expand, if you would, and how prediction markets show public opinion in ways that polling does not.
Right. Well, and prediction markets are not designed to take a snapshot. You know, polling is a snapshot. That's another distinction, right? With polling, the minute you've asked the question and gotten the answer from a voter, it starts to age because people change their mind, yada, yada. With a prediction market, the price is changing every second based upon what people are bidding and paying for these $1 winner-take-all contracts that an event will or will not occur. So by way of example, you know, which party will win the Wisconsin Senate race? Right now, you can say the Republicans will win the Wisconsin Senate race in 2022. That's trading at 72 cents. So if you put down 72 cents to buy that the Republicans will win, if the Republican wins and you bought one share, that 72 cent would resolve to $1. So you take home 28 cents profit. The person who put down the 28 cents saying that the Republicans will not win the Wisconsin Senate race, that would have cost 28 cents to say the Republicans will not win. That person would lose his 28 cents if, in fact, the Republicans won.
So I could buy in on the Democrat winning the U.S. Senate in November in Wisconsin. I could buy in on that now at the price it is. And if the price goes up between now and November, I could sell my shares?
Oh, yeah. You can love the Democrats at 28 cents and hate them at 30. So you could... That's one of the things that makes it really fun. And also, that's why these markets are so accurate, right? Because they react, they absorb information as it occurs. It's not a snapshot in time. It's constantly adjusting. There may be a flub. There may be something that happens. There will be something that happens in the race that will boost or reduce the price of these shares. And you can buy, you know, the idea is like a stock market. You buy low, you sell high. And you can make money just in the fluctuations of the day-to-day rough and tumble of a political campaign. So if you think your candidate is going to have a very good performance at a debate, for instance, you can buy that candidate's shares at whatever the price is. You wait until the debate happens. You cross your fingers that the other side is going to flub it during the debate, and then you sell your shares as soon as your shares go up.
Hmm. So,
or you can hang on to them, right?
Until yeah.
the election occurs.
But as I think about this, you're looking at the outcome of the one person, one vote representative republic that we have, but your market has the opportunity for people to buy in from anywhere from 1/100th of a dollar to $850. How does this production market better reflect the public than polling when you're not, it's not a one-to-one, it is whatever people are willing to pony up or can or afford to?
Well, that's right. So the market itself, if the question is, why are these markets so accurate? You know, markets generally, we know that markets are generally more accurate than public opinion polling. I have a lot of friends who are public opinion pollsters, and polling is very, very valuable for certain things. If you want to know why a voter thinks the way they do, or is saying they're going to vote a certain way, polling is terrific. Focus groups are very, very valuable for that purpose. But if you want to forecast far in advance of an event what's likely to happen, markets are the better bet.
John Aristotle Phillips is the founder of the political stock market Predict It. And it is available now. Right now, it shows if the election were held today, according to predictit.org, the money appears to be on the Republican winning the U.S. The Republican candidate winning the U.S. Senate election come November, and the Republican candidate winning the governor's race come November. Unnamed candidate in the market right now, but that's where the money is. And so what do you think about betting on politics? Who do you think will win the races for governor in the U.S. Senate this fall? And how will the money play out on the market at predictit.org? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, or email ideas at WPR.org. And we'll continue with John Aristotle Phillips, the founder of the political stock market Predict It, next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we know that elections matter, but can money help us to better predict their outcomes? Our guest is the founder of the political stock market, PredictIt.org, where the overwhelming money right now is on Cavalier Johnson to be the next mayor of Milwaukee and Mandela Barnes to win the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. What do you think about a stock exchange for political outcomes? 1-800-642-1234 to join us and our guest, John Aristotle Phillips, who is the founder of PredictIt.org. Amy in Galesville, good morning. You're on with John Aristotle Phillips.
Good morning. I am wondering if there's been research done as to whether, you know, betting on the outcome of an election affects how people vote.
And this has come up with polling as well, Amy, and it's a great question. John, do we know, has there been research into whether or not your market could actually influence voters' behavior?
That's a great question. So the research is ongoing in terms of, this is a small dollar market, but the research is ongoing in terms of how this impacts or informs voter behavior. We know, for instance, that it does affect engagement. So people who are following the stock market or invested in the stock market are much more likely to pay attention to how their stocks, I'm talking about Wall Street, how their stocks and the companies that they have an investment in, how they perform. And so there is significant evidence that when you have skin in the game, whether it's because you're betting on a sporting event, for just as an example, you're more likely to consume statistics and information about the sporting teams and the what the odds are. So there is a correlation between participation in this type of event and consumption of information. You're more likely to listen to radio and TV and read the newspapers and follow online.
But what if I don't put any money down? What if I don't have any skin in the game? What if all I see are the results from predictit.org? Could that in some way influence my behavior? Oh, you know, it's overwhelming. Cavalier Johnson has it in the bag, according to predictit.org. Why even participate?
Well, you know, let's break that down for just a second. Let's pick the Wisconsin Senate race. Which party will win the Wisconsin Senate race? So right now it's 72% odds that the Republicans, according to predicted at this moment, that the Republicans are going to win the Wisconsin Senate race. But that means that 28% of the time, the opposite will happen. So when something is 2-1 or 3-1 or 4-1 odds, that doesn't mean that the opposite isn't going to happen. It just means that the odds indicate that on the flip side of that, something else is going to happen. And yes, it will influence. There is a strong correlation to engagement. The question really becomes, you know, if you read the polls, for instance, and you see your candidate is lagging behind, the candidate that you oppose, are you less likely to go out and vote? Probably. I haven't seen that research, but I suspect that's the case.
Well, John, your organization, Aristotle Incorporated, I found this interesting, which runs predictit.org. It does so in partnership with Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. So you do have researchers working on what is happening in these markets. What's the relationship like with those researchers?
Oh, that's a great question. So Predictit was established with Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand, which had been, Victoria is a prominent university. They had been running a prediction market for 7 years prior to the initiation of Predictit. And it was a very good prediction market. In fact, it was global in scope. You could bet on all kinds of events and with small dollar. Its purpose was to understand better why markets are so predictive, as well as to make accurate forecasts of future events that are sometimes difficult to forecast. And we teamed up with Victoria University to bring that to the United States. In 2014. Now, since that time, more than 100 other academic institutions and research organizations have begun to accept the anonymized trading data for research purposes. This includes, for instance, Federal Reserve. West Point uses some of this information for teaching purposes. There are universities around the country in every state that utilize this information in one way or another to understand better why prediction markets are as accurate, or sometimes when they're not accurate, why that is, or to understand how prediction markets and markets generally serve as an engagement tool.
John, are we seeing academic research coming from the data anonymized, as you mentioned, from Predictit?
Oh, I'm sorry, the question again?
Are we seeing academic papers as a result of these anonymized data from Predictit?
Yeah. And you can Google some of the research if you're interested in it.
What are some of the conclusions? What are we finding?
Well, I mean, what we just talked about, for instance, Predictit as an engagement tool, for instance, it's proven to be quite effective for those purposes. Now, there are a number of professors that are using this as a teaching tool, for instance. You know, they might be in the economics department or the marketing department or the mathematics or political science department, for instance, or, you know, in foreign relations, for instance. How good are Predictit markets? When are they right on predicting something like Brexit? Or when are they wrong on forecasts of that nature? And keep in mind, because this is a small dollar, you know, the shares are, you know, trade from a penny to a dollar, and you can have up to $850 in any of these markets. Because it's a small dollar, it encourages people who wish to make a forecast to come in and buy a share. Or buy 100 shares, for instance, if they want, on a particular outcome or event. And as we talked about earlier, the cost on these, the price for these shares is constantly fluctuating based upon information coming into the market. Some of the most interesting research we alluded to earlier, I think, has to do with what makes somebody a better forecaster. What habits are indicative that somebody's going to be more accurate in his or her forecasts. You know, are Democrats better at forecasting Republican events, or are Republicans in the state, you know, outside of are voters outside of New Hampshire better or worse at forecasting the outcome of the New Hampshire Republican primary, for instance, in 2024? Those are all subjects that are being studied right now, and some of the research is starting to come out.
John Aristotle Phillips is the founder of the Political Stock Market Predict It, and there's still time for you. If you could be on political campaigns, would you put money on your preferred candidate or the person you think would win? 1-800-642-1234. And John, when the market gets an outcome wrong, what do you begin to look at? Are there variables that are lost, or, you know, what is it that skews a market sometimes that could make it a mistake?
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, when we say that the market gets it wrong, what that means is that something that might have been forecast at 45% odds actually occurs, right? Or something that might have been forecast at 25% odds actually occurs. And these markets are not, as I said earlier, are not perfect 2020 vision into the future, just like forecasting markets or commodities markets don't perfectly forecast, but they're pretty accurate. I think I would challenge your listeners to experiment with Predict It, because it's very interesting thing that happens when you have just a little bit of skin in the game. Put a couple bucks into one of these markets, you'll see how it affects your own psychology and how closely you might follow that race. And it really does. I know I can speak for myself, even though I'm not allowed to forecast on Predict It because we run the site. When you have a little bit of skin in the game, it really clears your head. And you start to, you know, we think of it sometimes as the antidote to fake news. Because if you rely in your forecasts on fake news, you're going to lose your money.
Wow. It's as simple as that. But and finally, you mentioned you had a million comments in 2016 after getting off the ground in 2014. The comments section is still available for your markets on predictit.org. What's the importance and power of those comments, John?
Oh, first of all, it's enormously entertaining. If you listen to the comments on any of these markets and participate in the comment section, it's a lot of fun. I mean, first of all, there are people in there commenting because they're trying to move the price up or down. And so they're weighing in. Then there are the true believers in there who are arguing against perhaps what the markets are showing, or arguing more strongly in favor that the odds should be higher. So you get all kinds of people in there who are submitting their opinions on why the price is right, why the price is too low, why the price is too high on a particular event occurring. And it's a lively, boisterous, totally entertaining, and frankly, just completely addictive behavior.
Engaging.
Place to be.
John, we're out of time.
Engaging is the word. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us, John.
Thanks very much.
John Aristotle Phillips, the founder of the Political Stock Market Predict It. After the news, we're going to be tackling ethics, the right and wrong of it all. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.